Loving Our Enemies, the seventh talk in a series on the Sermon on the Mount, was presented by Ron Julian on August 15, 2010 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2010. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We are in the book of Matthew, the fifth chapter. We're in the seventh week of our series on the Sermon on the Mount. We have been looking at the so-called antitheses. This is where Jesus says, "You have heard it said something, but I say to you." We'll finish that today. I have been arguing that, unlike the way some people take this section, that Jesus is not by any means intending to contradict or even improve on the Old Testament law, and hopefully that'll be real clear by the time we get done today. Instead, when he says, "You have heard it said," what he's talking about is the teaching of the Pharisees. He started this out by saying, "Your righteousness must exceed that of the scribes and the Pharisees." And what he's talking about is, you have heard it said by the Pharisees that righteousness is defined by these rules from the Old Testament. You have heard it said, do this, and the implication is, and if you just make sure that you've done that, then you're obviously a righteous person. And in each case, what he's doing is expanding, not correcting the Old Testament, not even adding to it, I would say, but basically bringing out the implications of what had been there all the time. So we're going to finish the antitheses today. We're starting in Matthew 5:38. "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist him who is evil. But whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat also. And whoever shall force you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks of you, and do not turn away from him who wants to borrow from you." Okay, so what we have to talk about today is probably fairly simple, although there are some things that are going to need to be explained for sure. We all recognize in the teaching that we're looking at today something that is very challenging. I mean, it's very basic and very fundamental and something that at times that is difficult to face into, talking about how we interact with other people. Now, remember that Jesus introduced this whole section by making this point, your righteousness must exceed that of the scribes and the Pharisees. So when he says here, you have heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, he means you have heard it said by the Pharisees that if you are keeping the commandment, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, then you can consider yourself to be a righteous follower of the law. In other words, the command, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, gives me a certain license to strike back when someone has offended against me. So, again, what I'm going to try to argue as we go through this is not that the Old Testament was wrong in this or that Jesus is correcting this, but it is a misapplication and understanding of what the Old Testament was saying by the Pharisees that Jesus is addressing here. So, first of all, we want to try to understand that law itself, that phrase from the Old Testament, an eye for an eye. The language of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth comes from several of God's instructions in civil law to Israel. These are situations where he is talking about various situations where someone has harmed another person in some way, deliberately, not deliberately, and there are these various regulations for how should the judges rule as someone has been harmed by someone else and they come before the judges of the people, what should be the procedure? How should they assess these things. Let me quote one place where this language shows up from Deuteronomy 19:16. If a malicious witness rises up against a man to accuse him of wrongdoing, then both the men who have the dispute shall stand before the Lord, before the priests and the judges who will be in office in those days. And the judges shall investigate thoroughly, and if the witness is a false witness and he has accused his brother falsely, then you shall do to him just as he had intended to do to his brother. Thus you shall purge the evil from among you. And the rest will hear and be afraid and will never again do such an evil thing among you. Thus you shall not show pity. Life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Okay, so here we have this instruction. This is what the judges should do. In this particular case, if someone, you know, I'm testifying against you that you did something that deserves capital punishment. Well, it turns out I'm lying to try to do you in. They should turn around and execute me instead, is basically saying. What I was going to do should be done to me. As I see it, these instructions are within the covenant that God made with Israel. God was very serious about his people dealing ruthlessly with evil. And so we see this language, so you shall purge the evil from among you. We could spend some time sorting out exactly why God gave a command like this. At this point, I believe it was partly an issue of justice and partly an issue of religious purity. That is, this is not just the perfect civil law for any society. This is in the theocracy of Israel under the covenant that God had made. This was a part of what God had done. Very strict regulations on what would be allowed and capital punishment for many, many infractions, including religious ones. But what's important, I think, for us to understand here, for whatever reason it was given in the civil law, it is a part of the judicial system of Israel. It is part of the instruction for judges. This is the way you should judge when cases like this come before you. So when we look at the language, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, there's something kind of attractive about that language, because it speaks to something that we all have in us, that natural sort of desire to strike back in an appropriate way. You hit me, I hit you back. You know, that, and there's something in us. There's a sense of justice that wants that, to have something like that happen, and there's something else as well in us that responds to that. So that language, an eye for an eye, says, that sounds like an attractive way to live. Don't mess with me, because you do something to my eye, I'll do something to your eye. And I can describe myself as a religious person. I am a righteous person in doing this, because look, the law said an eye for an eye. Well, is an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth intended to be instruction to us how we individually should deal with other people? Not at all. In fact, I think we can clearly see that God gave very different instructions for individuals, the most important of which is what Jesus calls the second of the two great commandments, the famous verse from Leviticus 19, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." But we often don't quote the whole verse in its context, which is even more relevant to what we're looking at right now. In Leviticus 19:17, "You shall not hate your fellow countrymen in your heart. You may surely reprove your neighbor, but shall not incur sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance, nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord." Okay, so we see there this fundamental moral principle, which was recognized by many of the Jews at the time. If you'll remember, in the New Testament, Jesus was asked on several occasions what the greatest of the commandments were, and sometimes his answer, love God and love your neighbor as yourself, would be approved by the person asking him, you're right, you've got it exactly right. You understand very well what the law is getting at. So it's not that Jesus is the only one who understood this. But this was one of the fundamental moral principles of the Old Testament. Individuals were not to take vengeance, but instead were to love their neighbors as themselves. And in the New Testament, this same idea is commended to us in many places. Paul himself describes it as the summation of the law. If you want to sum up what the law is all about, that command there captures it very well. So we have this tension between the law given to the civil court, an eye for an eye administered to someone who has committed some offense. There's this sort of retaliation involved. But the tension is with the individual instruction to us that we are not to take vengeance, but to consider the needs of the neighbor as if we were thinking about ourselves. Well, it's not really a tension at all, because they're two very different things. But for the Pharisees, who tended to be fairly literalistic in the way they applied the law, an eye for an eye then becomes an excuse to justify my own vindictiveness. I'm only giving you back what you gave me. And that's the principle in the law. Give them back what they gave. So it's not appropriate for me to kill you if you put my eye out, but it is appropriate for me to take your eye out if you took my eye out, because that's appropriate and just. So Jesus says in response to this, no, how should we individually respond to those who do things that we don't like? He says, don't resist him who is evil. Instead, turn the other cheek, give your coat also, go the extra mile, give to him who asks you. All right, so now we want to try to understand his answer a little better here. First of all, and I think this is very important in dealing with this passage, we want to try to understand the underlying principle under what Jesus is saying here. Because this is a famous passage, and people can end up taking it in different directions, depending on what you see as central to Jesus' purpose here. Some have concluded from this passage that Jesus is primarily advocating pacifism and nonviolence. Why should you not resist evil? Because it is wrong for you to resist evil, because it involves you in doing the very same thing that the evil person is doing. So if they are pushing at you, it would be wrong for you to push back under any circumstances, so therefore you should just let it go. It is always wrong to fight physically. It is always wrong to fight verbally. Therefore, the righteous thing to do, just by definition, I don't care what they did, the righteous thing to do is nothing. Do not respond in kind. And many people take this passage to be saying that, basically, that the underlying principle is it is just wrong for us to ever fight in any way, to respond, to deal harshly with someone, to fight physically with someone, to resist verbally to someone. It is wrong for us to do that. The way of righteousness is the way of non-resistance and non-violence. I think, however, that there is a different principle behind what Jesus is saying here. I would argue that Jesus is fleshing out that commandment to love your neighbor as yourself. Do not take vengeance, but love your neighbor as yourself. He's reminding us that we are called not to take vengeance and instead to love our neighbor as ourselves. And he's picked a very striking and provocative way of showing what that might look like in certain situations. Okay, well, why am I making a big deal about that? Why does it matter to us what the underlying principle is? Well, I think it makes a lot of difference, actually. If Jesus is saying that fighting back of any kind is always wrong, that has clear implications for how we ought to conduct ourselves and where we ought to go with this teaching. The principle is that I should never stop anyone from doing anything bad because I am not allowed to fight back. And so then that could extend to lots of situations. If someone is robbing my house, can I stop them? Or am I, in resisting them, am I disobeying what Jesus has said here? It's just always wrong for us to resist. So if they want it, just let them take it. If someone is trying to kill me, is it okay for me to resist them? Or would resisting them involve me in violent activity that is never right for a follower of God? It would never be right for me to be violent or resist in that way, so I have to just let them kill me. Jesus would be saying that I should never stoop to their level by meeting force with force or even meeting harsh words with harsh words. Many Christians throughout the centuries have believed and taught that this is what Jesus means, that basically it is wrong for me to in any way involve myself in activity which is violent or harsh, therefore I just let people do it. All right, but see, I don't think that's the principle that's involved here. I don't think that's what Jesus is getting at. I think probably the main reason I would say that is it doesn't seem to me that the Bible as a whole supports that picture. I mean, I know that this passage is often appealed to as kind of the foundational passage, and other things in the Bible are kind of pushed aside as secondary, but I think those other things in the Bible ought to give me some sort of picture of where God is coming from. I don't see the Bible saying that resisting evil people is wrong in principle. Jesus resisted evil people and urged us to do so. Jesus did all kinds of things. People wanted him to do stuff, and he left. So, no, I'm not going to let you do that. He went into the temple and with a whip and whipped the animals and stuff to move them out and knocked people's stuff over. I mean, he was fairly violent in that situation. And people debate on whether he used the whip on the people there or only the animals. That would be a strong, you know, that would help my case. Unfortunately, I actually don't think he used the whip on people, so that doesn't quite go there. But, I mean, this is not non-resistance. This is, hey, this is bad. Whack. So, and I don't see the same thing is when we look at Paul and the other apostles. It is not a principle that you just lie back and let evil people walk over you. That doesn't seem to be the fundamental principle that the Bible is advocating. And we are often urged to resist or rebuke or discipline or speak out or various things that involve resisting what evil people want to do. So I don't think that's the principle that Jesus is appealing to. I think that Jesus is instead challenging us to live out the implications of loving our neighbor. The principle is that I should be as concerned for the other guy's welfare as I am with my own. That's what loving your neighbor as yourself is all about. So when somebody has done something to me, that desire, that vindictive desire for vengeance, to get mine back, that's the thing that's wrong. That's the thing that's bad, because I am seeking to satisfy my own desire for vengeance instead of asking myself the question, what is in the best interests of this person? And that's what Jesus is calling us to think about what is in the best interests of this person. I think in these examples in particular, Jesus is calling us to communicate our goodwill to the other person by not responding in kind. The one that makes the most sense to me is the one about going the extra mile. It was not uncommon that a soldier has carrying his stuff and he's going along the road might impress someone into service, basically say, I don't carry this stuff, you carry this stuff, I'm going a mile down the, okay, we'll go as far as whatever, and you're going to carry this stuff. So if I go the first mile, I'm doing it because I have to. I'm being compelled to. The second mile, I was not compelled to do that. Clearly, I'm doing it because I want to help you carry your stuff or whatever it is involved in this situation. It, by voluntarily doing what I was compelled to do before, now I have shifted things and communicated the idea that I'm actually thinking about you, even though you did this thing that I didn't like, even though you compelled me to do something, and I don't think that was a kind or good thing to do, still I'm thinking about you. And I think that's what Jesus is trying to shock us into seeing here, that we, by not responding in kind, have the opportunity for something redemptive. That, after all, is what loving your neighbor as yourself is all about. It means I'm considering the best interests of the other person as well as my own. I'm giving up that natural desire that I have to satisfy myself and get vengeance. And instead, I'm thinking about what's good for the other person. So this changes how we see the implications of what Jesus is saying. If the issue is loving my neighbor as myself, then turn the other cheek stops being an absolute rule. He's giving a striking, proverbial, shocking sort of example of the sort of thing that you might be called upon to do, to turn the other cheek. Is turning the other cheek always the appropriate thing to do? Well, if the issue is what is in the best interest of the other person, I would say a full-blown biblical picture of what it means to be a wise and loving person would say, no, sometimes that's not the right thing to do. If a robber is trying to shoot me and steal my money, is it serving his best interests somehow to just let him do it? Is somehow I am seeking his welfare in doing that? I don't see why that would necessarily be the case. Remember when Paul is before the Sanhedrin and he is struck on the face. Paul doesn't turn the other cheek. Instead, he says, God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall, and do you sit and try me according to the law and in violation of the law order me to be struck? Okay, well, we might argue, all right, well, so Paul lost it in this situation. He was supposed to turn the other cheek, and instead he got all angry and did this stuff. But I don't think that's the way we read that. I don't think that's what we see in that situation. In what Paul clearly felt was called for was to call these religious leaders on their essential hypocrisy in that situation. And sometimes that's what love requires, is to speak back and say, you know, you need to face into something here. So it's not that don't respond is the principle. It is actively seek the welfare of everyone. That, I think, is the principle that's involved here. Jesus' main purpose in saying this, remember, is to challenge the so-called righteousness of the Pharisees. The Pharisees would defend their vindictive behavior by saying, look, the law says an eye for an eye. All I did was strike back, same way I was struck. So as far as the law is concerned, I'm good. It's legal and godly for me to retaliate in this way against anyone who does wrong. But in doing this, the Pharisees have forgotten that an eye for an eye has a particular place in God's purposes. It is a part of the civil law under the covenant that God made with Israel. The standard for personal behavior is you shall not take vengeance, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And what we have seen is that in several places, it is the principle, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, that the Pharisees have forgotten in their defense of their behavior by an appeal to another law. Hey, I haven't murdered anyone. Yeah, but what about loving your neighbor as yourself and loving God as well? Okay, so what Jesus does in this situation is to shock them and shocks us at the same time, by saying that love should be prepared to go so far as turn the other cheek and go the extra mile. There are times when that's exactly what we should do. But I think the statement, this is what you should do, we take in the same way we take in the statement, if your right eye offends you, tear it out. It's not just a command, go rip your eye out. It's we're being called upon to step back and say, what is he calling us to here? What is he getting at? Okay, now the next and last of the antitheses is closely related to this one. They're really meant to go together, I think, starting in verse 43. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, in order that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax gatherers do the same? And if you greet your brothers only, what do you do more than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? Therefore, you are to be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. Okay, so a little bit different with this one in that there is no passage in the Old Testament that says, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. You're not going to find that specifically in the Old Testament. But I think as we look at what's been going on in the context, and here it makes a lot of sense to see what Jesus is doing is summing up the way the Pharisees would portray what the Old Testament is saying. And it's not hard to see how that might happen. The love your neighbor part comes from Leviticus. And at the same time, the Old Testament talks a lot about the enemies of Israel, which are really seen as the enemies of God. God is going to conquer them, defeat them, destroy them. It will be a great day for Israel when their enemies are put down. And God is a God of judgment as well as mercy. And ultimately, the enemies of God will be judged. I mean, that is an Old Testament theme. That is a New Testament theme. So I think what the Pharisees have done, though, in essence, is to say, all right, look, we see this love your neighbor as yourself. And there's kind of this emphasis upon, you know, kind of like your brother, your neighbor is kind of the one who's in it with you. And then the enemies are those out there who are against you. And so that must mean then that what we are called to do is love the good guys and hate the bad guys. Again, on a personal level now, I can justify my conduct towards people and basically by saying, well, you a good guy? You treat me well? You believe in God? Do the right stuff? Okay. I love you. Everybody else, I'm not obligated to you because you're the enemy. And the enemy is going to be dealt with ultimately. But again, the Pharisees have fallen into a profound misunderstanding. Love your neighbor as yourself is an inclusive statement about how to treat your fellow man ultimately. It is not giving us the limited set of people we have to love. When it says love your neighbor, it's not love your neighbor, you know, not those other guys, just your neighbor. It's the only one that you have to love as yourself, which is kind of the way the Pharisees were taking it. You may recall that, well, I'll wait on that. I think I have that coming up here. Okay, Jesus says that we should love our enemies so that we can be sons of our Father in heaven. As I've mentioned in an earlier talk, the Son reflects the qualities of the Father. It's like that language, a chip off the old block. If you're a son, one of the sons of God, then you're showing it by the fact that you understand his character and are reflecting that. You are seeking to be like he is. And in this case, our Heavenly Father is one who shows great restraint, being gracious to everyone, even those who ultimately will be judged as his enemies. Yes, we can see the language of enemy in the Old Testament. There are the enemies of God, and judgment is going to come upon them ultimately. But meanwhile, how is God dealing with those enemies? He gives them the sun. He sends them the rain. He gives them life. He sustains their life. There are all these many gifts that God gives even to those who have set themselves firmly against him. He sends the rain on the just and the unjust alike, as it says. So this merciful restraint is exactly what God was getting at in the Old Testament with the command to not take vengeance, but instead to love your neighbor as yourself. We are to emulate this aspect of God's character in not using the very real offenses of other people as justification for mistreating them, but instead to actually be merciful towards them, recognizing that they are made in the image of God just as I am. Okay, now Jesus then confronts the Pharisaical thinking with some common sense, is how I would understand this next part. He says, look, you guys think that if loving your neighbor and hating your enemy is, this is what the law calls for, then this is what God would be pleased with. You will be rewarded for following the law. Love your neighbor, hate your enemy. But how could that be true? Does that really make sense that God would deal that way? The rankest pagan loves the good guys. I mean, is there anybody in the world that doesn't treat people well who treat them well? I mean, we tend to accept and treat well the people who treat us well, and the ones who don't, we don't. Why in the world would God command us to do that which we all do naturally? Why would God reward us as obedient and faithful followers of God just for doing what we all want to do anyway? Being nice to people you like is not much of a moral challenge, and yet you guys are congratulating yourselves for doing it. I think that's what he's basically getting at here. Does this make any sense? That there would be some reward with God for treating your brothers well, for treating loving those who love you? Why would God think that's hot stuff? Okay, so then Jesus comes to his conclusion. Therefore, you are to be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. All right, and I want to talk about this one a little bit because that one's tricky. It is very common to translate it the way the New American Standard has, and I left it that way. You are to be perfect. And then typically this is taken to be kind of a summing up of this whole section of the antitheses. Jesus says, your righteousness must exceed that of the Pharisees. Don't hate in your heart. Don't commit adultery in your heart. Don't divorce. Don't make vows. In fact, love your enemy, so forth. In fact, you just need to be absolutely morally perfect. Let me sum up what I'm getting at. Your righteousness needs to exceed that of the scribes and the Pharisees. You need to be perfect, morally perfect without flaw in any way. And then, of course, we confront the fact that we can't do that. Even believers are not without flaw, are not morally perfect. So this must be a part of what is Jesus' overall fundamental purpose in this section, is to confront us with the demands of the law for perfection, and then we despair and say, oh no, what will I do? And then I hear the gospel and I go to the cross. Well, I don't think that's what this verse is doing. I'm willing for it to do that. You can believe me or not, but I'm not trying to make it say something different than that. I would be quite happy for it to say that, because I believe ultimately in the idea that the law ultimately drives us to recognize our own innate sinfulness and drives us to seek the grace of God. I think that's what Paul talks about in Romans. I just don't think that's the fundamental point that Jesus is making here, and I don't think that's what he means by this sentence. I disagree with the common interpretation in two ways. One, I think the word should be translated differently because it's misleading to us, this word perfect. This is a word that is used a lot in the New Testament. Oftentimes, I think it should not be translated perfect because it's misleading to us what that word means. I would argue in this case that something more like complete is the word. And two, I think this is the conclusion not of the whole section, but of this particular statement, of this section about loving your enemies. This, therefore, is his conclusion to the loving your enemies part. Okay. So let's look at the structure. Let me show you what I'm talking about here. Jesus says, be like your Father, who gives the sun and rain not just to the righteous, but also to the unrighteous. So be like your Father. Be sons of God. Be like him. And that you're not only just giving your gifts to the good guys, but you're being gracious and including everyone. Do you think that God would see you as faithful if you only love people you like? Is there some? Do you have some reason to think that that's what God's interested in, is people who just love the people who love them? No, you should be complete in your love, just as God is complete in his. Don't think that a partial love counts for anything. Okay, now let me throw in a little bit more evidence for this. None of this is conclusive, but I think it's a pretty strong case, actually. But interestingly, in the parallel account in Luke, when Jesus is talking about loving your enemies, he uses different language. He does not say, be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. He says, be merciful as your heavenly Father is merciful. Well, I think basically in this context, those two statements mean the same thing. Don't be partial and incomplete in your love, only loving those whom you think deserve it, but be complete in your love, showing mercy to those who you feel do not deserve it. So be merciful as God is merciful. Be complete, not partial, but whole in your love as God is whole. At any rate, that's what I think is happening there. So all of that is about loving your enemies, and basically his language is simply urging us to emulate God in his gracious sending rain on the just and the unjust alike. Okay, so this is a hard teaching. There's no question about it. I mean, anytime you're talking about loving your enemies and loving your neighbors, yourself, and all that kind of stuff, we confront something that's very difficult to deal with. But I don't think in this case, in using that language, that Jesus was calling for moral perfection. He is criticizing the Pharisees for ignoring the law's demand that they treat all people well. The law did make provision in its civil law for punishing evildoers, and God made it clear that he would ultimately judge evil and condemn those who rebel against him. So yes, there is a judgmental retribution aspect to the law, but it's part of the civil law, and it is the right of God, or else it is the right of God in his ultimate judgment on the world. But as far as our personal behavior goes, we are called upon to refrain from vengeance and seek to do good for all people. In this, we are emulating God, who has graciously given gifts to all people, even those who one day will be judged by him. Okay, so have a couple of things to say then about this section. First of all, I want to make a comment about the antitheses as a whole, this whole section that we've been looking at for a couple weeks. Now that we have seen all of them, I think we can see even more clearly that Jesus has not corrected or changed anything in the Old Testament. He is not even adding to what was in the Old Testament. He's not coming along and saying, that was good, but I've got something even better. I would argue that everything he argues for in this section is already fully supported and commanded in the Old Testament. The question is just how do you put the pieces together? In each case, Jesus is merely correcting a legalistic misapplication of individual verses. And in each case, I would argue, he has basically said that each command must be understood in the light of the fuller teaching of the Old Testament. Now, he doesn't usually spell it out. He doesn't go back and quote things to make his point. But I would say you don't have to look very far to see that his points are fully supported by the important fundamental teachings in the Old Testament law. Does not murdering make me a righteous man? Well, no. God's deeper requirement is that we love God and love our neighbor. So having a heart filled with hate is just as morally wrong as murder. The consequences in the world are better if I'm not murdering people right and left, but the state of our heart fundamentally is what's at issue, and not having committed the outward act of murder doesn't mean that my heart is in the state that a believer's heart ought to be. Does not committing adultery make me a righteous man? Well, no. God's deeper requirement is that we not covet our neighbor's wife. To nurse our unrighteous desires and cling to them in our hearts is just as evil. Again, it has better consequences in the world if I keep my adultery in my heart. But in terms of my own moral standing before God, I can't say, look, I'm keeping the law, because I'm absolutely not keeping the law. I'm violating one of the fundamental tenets of that law. Does following the law and giving a certificate of divorce, if I want to divorce my wife, make me a righteous man? No, God created marriage to be permanent and exclusive. Just because there was provision for divorce doesn't mean that you can congratulate yourself as being a righteous man if you divorce. Does only breaking vows that are not to the Lord make me a righteous man? That is, if every time I make a vow to the Lord, I keep it, and then every time I make a vow that's not to the Lord, I break it, does that make me a righteous man because the law said you must fulfill your vows to the Lord? Well, no. I am called to love God and love my neighbor. I am not doing either if I manipulate and defraud through the use of my vows. Does the law about an eye for an eye make me a righteous man if I take vengeance? Am I exempted from loving my enemies? No, God wants our personal behavior to be characterized by abandoning vengeance and instead loving our neighbors as ourselves. This means every one of my fellow human beings, ultimately. So in each case, Jesus has done the same thing. He has accused the Pharisees of selectively obeying certain rules while missing the moral essence of the law. He has not changed or added to the law. He is only making clear what was always there. And doing it in such a way that he's highlighting, this is the difference between someone who is actually interested in following God and someone who's just pretending to follow God. This is why your righteousness has to exceed that of the scribes and the Pharisees. It's not that the scribes and, I've said this before, but it's not that the scribes and Pharisees did pretty well, but we have to do even better. What he's saying is the scribes and Pharisees are fake. Whatever righteousness they claim to have is a fake righteousness. It is not rooted in a heart that actually wants to know who God is and what he wants. It is rooted in a heart that delights in self-approval and the approval of the crowd, and if I can follow certain rules and approve of myself at the same time, great. That's what that religion in its worst practitioners was all about. What he's saying is you need to have a righteousness that has some real righteousness in it. I mean, that's actually interested in the fact that God cares about what your heart is set on and whether you're willing to take your place as a fellow creature alongside your neighbor and treat them in that way. Now, by no means is Jesus saying, so you earn your salvation by being morally perfect at this. I don't think that's what he's getting at all. But what he is saying is if you're hiding from it, if you're trying to deny that you have an obligation to love your neighbor as yourself when it actually gets out there in the world, if you're trying to somehow pretend that, no, I'm right, I'm justified, I've followed the rules, and I get to hate my neighbor at the same time, then there's something really fundamentally wrong, which was what was wrong with the leaders of the Pharisees, at least. Okay, I have one other comment to make. It's funny to me, I think it's sort of ironic. In the earlier part of the Sermon on the Mount, when we're looking at the Beatitudes, language about hungering and thirsting after righteousness or mourning and, you know, poor in spirit and that kind of stuff, I can read that sort of thing and have some sort of sense of, yeah, that, you know, I know something about what that's like. When I read the stuff about love your enemies and all of this, I don't know about you, but I feel the weight of it. To be a loving person is a costly thing. It costs us a lot to actually care about other people the way we care about ourselves. It just does. It does in all kinds of situations. And yet, the irony for me is that I at the same time, believe very firmly that this is a foundational truth for us. You know, Paul didn't make a mistake in all of his discussion about being justified by faith and not by works and all that kind of stuff to come along and say, you know, the law is captured, is summed up in the statement, love your neighbor as yourself. He's not wrong about that. He didn't have a little lapse where he forgot that we were justified by faith. I mean, that's exactly at the heart of what we're called to, is that I accept that I am a creature of God who is following a God who has a certain character, who is merciful and gracious, has been merciful to me, and I am a fellow creature with my neighbor, no more important or less important than any other human being on the planet. That's just a fundamental truth. If we're a Christian at all, that's what we believe. That's what God thinks. That's how he made things. That's just the bottom line where we are. So, in a way, it's very easy to understand. And it's very difficult to do. But the irony for me is that as hard as it is to do this, and as much as I feel, I really sincerely have feelings at times standing up here talking about this stuff, like, why in the world am I up here talking about this? You know, why am I standing up here saying you guys should be doing it the way I'm doing it? No, I'm not saying that at all. I mean, I'm trying, but this is really hard. I mean, it costs a lot to think about other people. It just does. So, but it's fundamental, and it applies in most of the aspects of our life, because most of our life is involved with relationships of one sort or another. And if you're involved with a relationship with another human being in any way, then you're going to face into this issue sooner or later. It may be that in my day-to-day life, I don't have to deal with many enemies. I mean, people that I would actually say are actively seeking my harm. But I do have to deal with people that have disappointed me in some way. And I really think that this teaching here has a lot to say to us about everything we do and as we're interacting with people. For example, you want to know what the greatest advice we can give someone is concerning marriage? I believe this firmly, and I have done this in the past, and I have had to talk to myself about this in the past. One of the greatest teachings on marriage is love your enemy. Now, is my spouse my enemy? Probably not. I mean, sometimes marriages get to the place where it seems like that. But the principle that applies in love your enemy applies just as well to love that irritating person who I wish would stop doing that stuff. I mean, it's the same thing. Our spouse can easily do things that arouse in us a desire to strike back or to get passive aggressive and just not say anything. Or we can nurse dissatisfaction and resentment over those things that disappoint us. You know that we can. We do it. We do it very easily. It is so easy to fall into this. I mean, I'm very serious here. If you are thinking, I don't really know what he's talking about here, I think you need to, like, go take the bonehead class or something, because that's one of those things that you should have figured out by now. If you haven't figured out that you have this tendency to be resentful and again, with people in your life that do things that you don't want done, and wanting to respond in some way to make them pay or to make them stop it or something like that. Our relationships can easily become strained because we feel entitled to act on our disappointment. We just do. This is just the way we are. We do this all the time. Well, and let me be clear here that I'm not talking about communicating our disappointments or disagreements. Talking about them can be a great thing. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with saying, you know, I was very disappointed when you said that thing to me, or that really hurt my feelings or something like that. That's not the sort of thing that I'm talking about. I'm talking about whether I'm willing to love my neighbor as myself, including loving my enemy, which means loving that person who at this moment is against me in some way, has done something to me in some way. And the question is, in that case, am I willing to stop and look at myself and ask the question, do I want what is good for them at this moment? I'm talking about seeking the good of my spouse, even if I'm hurt or disappointed or whatever. It is one of the hardest and yet most fundamental principles in all human relationships. Don't take vengeance. Instead, care about the other person's welfare as much as your own. That's why Jesus pointed to that Leviticus passage and said it's one of the two great commandments. That's why Paul can say, you want to know what the law, you want to sum up what the law is about, basically? Love your neighbor as yourself. That's what the law is about. So understanding this helps us to sort out sometimes difficult situations. Is Jesus really saying, always give people what they ask for? No, I don't think so. He didn't always give people what they asked for. But what he is saying is, always seek the welfare of the other person, even if it ends up being costly to me. So at times, that might mean generously giving what you otherwise might want to keep to yourself. But is it always loving to say yes? Well, the Bible and experience tells us that no, sometimes it is more loving to say no. Sometimes we see that actually advocated in the Bible. Out of love, don't go along. I mean, that's not in violation of what Jesus is saying here. The issue is, love your neighbor as yourself. I'm deeply convinced that we should commit ourselves to seeking the welfare of others in every relationship. That's the fundamental principle that we are called to. Every relationship we have, to seek the welfare of the other person, as well as our own. It's not a set of rules. Turn the other cheek, go the extra mile, is not this rule that says, if you're ever in a situation where someone hits you on the cheek, the new rule is, you always must turn the other cheek. That's not the point of what he's saying, I don't think. Instead, he's trying to shock us into recognizing this principle. Am I willing to seek what is good for everyone I deal with? Even those that I'm not so happy with right now. This is the guide, the touchstone by which we can assess our choices as we relate to others. And that's why I say it's so important, for example, in marriage. I mean, sometimes stopping and reminding yourself, I am called to be concerned about the welfare of my enemy, can be a very useful thing to do in the midst of the struggles of marriage. I know it sounds weird. It's kind of extreme. My enemy. She's not my enemy. But I can just, it's a bracing wake-up sort of, yeah, okay. This is about caring about other people, that is, acting towards them for their good. Sometimes you have to say harsh things. Sometimes you have to do things that the other person's not going to like. But always, the principle I'm pursuing is what I'm doing to the best of my understanding for their good. Not for my good, for their good. Not for my good alone, at least. Okay, so I'd be happy to take any questions or comments you might have.
Thanks, Ron. Some years ago, I was a civil filings clerk, and fortunately didn't have to be in the courtroom or anything like that. But it was always so wonderful to file a dismissal to a case, meaning that the people, plaintiff and defendant, were able to get together, get their mutual needs expressed and resolved outside of court. And then from that perspective, I think, that's the whole purpose of the whole court system, is to make things big enough to hopefully get people's attention so that they work things out on their own. And secondly, I'd heard from someone who works in the Lane County Jail or something like that, that the purpose of incarceration isn't for punitive purposes, but rather for the good of the people, the families, and whoever else, is to separate this person who is just not getting it, to separate them from the rest of society, to keep them from hurting any more than hurting people more than any than they have previously. And so this really, you're so right that it's such a balancing act that one can do the legally right thing with a rip-roaring, vengeful heart, or rather of a case, okay, what's the big picture here? What's the hard truths that we need to be dealing with here? So good for you for diving in here.
Yeah, I like that. I like what you said, that the attraction of that time when they resolve things. The second thing you said, up to a point, I think I can agree with that. There does come back to that issue, the element of justice. Like, for instance, a financial penalty or something like that. That doesn't take the person out of, remove them from society or something like that. But we have this judgment that they owe it. I mean, there's something right about them having to make some sort of response given what it is that they had done. And I wouldn't want us to lose that. What's tricky is when we're dealing with the Old Testament law is there's this further purpose, which is I don't think actually is appropriate for our legal system to try to embrace, which is the enforcement of the covenant that God made with Israel and this idea that God was going to establish, he's going to make a kingdom so righteous that there was no room for violation of it. You're out. If you know, you're executed and gone if you're not. And that adds a layer to the Old Testament law that we have to sort out when we're looking at that stuff too, I think. Yeah, that's good. Thanks.
Thanks, Ron. Amen, and amen for a couple of things. First, old business. Thank you for kind of separating last week or the previous week the idea of if you have something with your brother when you come to the altar, you know, lay down your offering, and separating that from communion. Mm-hmm. And as I was taking communion today at an Episcopal church for a baby's christening and baptism, it just struck me how guilt-laden communion can be. So, at least for me, growing up, So thank you.
Yeah, I agree. No, I agree. Good.
And then, this week, I do appreciate you bringing out, it's fascinating to me that the harshness of the eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, comes from an Old Testament teaching, apparently, on those who bear false witness, malicious false witness.
There are some other places, too. Yeah. I quoted one of them. But
yeah. So that would be interesting to look
into. Right.
But I know even marriage and so forth, it's so easy to start down that, you know, self-justification and starting to talk to myself about, you know, how evil my spouse is. Or And so thank you.
Right, yeah. A lot of imaginary conversations in the shower, if you know what I mean. Standing there, warm water. Yeah, I should have said this. And I'm not just with spouses, with all kinds of people. I've had imaginary conversations with many of you, actually, in my mind, in that shower. So
that's information, Ron.
That's right. All right. Anything else? Okay.